Summer Interior. After Edward Hopper, 1909. And maybe she is dreaming about a boy in Duluth who left her, a blossom at each of his temples. It's summer, and only this boy running the bath could tell her if it's morning or the moon that shatters so neatly on the linoleum, rapture or its shadow that will haunt her. This is how it's been since May, since they swayed together in the open door of the freighter and watched Nebraska go by. Ogallala, Ogden, Promontory, the kinglets swinging the telegraph wires where they sang. When there is nothing left to say, you say it. And she is thinking of how she will cradle his face in her hands, this boy she does not love, her hair cascading around the thin of him, and name for him all the places they have gone from, Kearney, Fremont, Lone Tree, as the ancients had a thousand words for abandon. She likes to think, even now, of this boy stooping down to sweep up the shards of snifters they shattered in the pitch of it. The way, when it was over, she held him with neither pity nor compassion, the way the stars do in the great dramas that are happening without her. The newlyweds, the motor girl, the follies, the fierce lights of the city opening out before them. Only desire can bring you so low, kneel you on the floor of your one sweet life. Only desire can gift you with a dark veil in the steady light. Summer, and when they smelled the elkhorn crashing past the silos, they jumped down and ran to it in their stolen clothes, the land's chaff sifting through their fingers. Only he could see the scar between her shoulders. Only she could see the evening on the far bank, a salt-haired man wading out with a saddle, a woman carrying her cello full of hay, and a foal's shoes in their old wool when she left them. Summer now, and the room is full of a steady light. Look at her, her tousled blouse like linen, the mustard walls, the mantle's perfect grammar. Why should they mourn? The granaries are open and the swift world isn't listening. Look at him, his shadow in the bedpost. And now she is rising in the steady light. And now he is standing in the threshold, laughing as she dances toward the water, dancing as she casts his hands away. Look at them, the echo of their dancing. There are the moon's flocks and the day's wings in our branches, and the moments when the lost ghosts in our bodies lift us just as lightly as the ones who mean to stay.
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, welcome to Poets Cafe. We're here with Joseph Fasano, author of three books of poetry, Vincent, Inheritance, and Fugue for Other Hands, which won the Sartor Press Review Book Award and was nominated for the Poets Prize, awarded annually for the best book of verse published by a living American poet. A winner of the Rattle Poetry Prize, he's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and the Kate Tufts Discovery Award, among other honors. His recent writing has appeared in publications such as the Yale Review, the Southern Review, Boston Review, Tin House, the Missouri Review, the Times Literary Supplement, and American Poet Magazine. Welcome back,
yeah,
Joseph.
It's great to be here. I was saying earlier how much just has happened, both to the country and to me, it seems personally, between last time I saw you, I guess it was about 2 years.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful to be back and to be talking and talking about poems with you.
We're surviving it.
We're surviving and thriving.
Right. And you began with this gorgeous, gorgeous piece, Summer
Thank
Interior,
you.
Which is inspired by the Edward Hopper painting. Ekphrastic is a big word, and it's very encompassing. What does that mean for our listeners to you? What is that ekphrastic work?
It's a Greek word, and sort of it really has has a meaning of description. I describe what I see, what I look at. But I take it very seriously as coming out of another source. I think of looking at ekphrastic poetry, for a very simple explanation, would be poetry that is based on another work of art in a different medium. Mm-hmm. So you look at a painting or a drawing or a sculpture, and it's not quite description that you're doing, is it? You're using that as a little seedling that you're planting in your brain, and you're letting yourself go, perhaps in another direction. Right. And, you know, I'm very humbled by the exercise because it does feel, in a sense, like an act of translation. I use that phrase in the poem, "The mantle's perfect grammar," which is really quite a strange thing to say because, of course, you're looking at a painting that is silence. The artist creating that work was interested in a very different medium than what I, as a poet, am interested in. But nonetheless, he was interested in form and giving form to a certain chaotic mm-hmm. emotional experience. And so I think there is a grammar to that. So there's a way of looking at it and finding in it also a story, which I think is a fundamental human gesture to look at an experience, look at an image, and to find in it or to try to find in it a story, which, of course, is really what we do in our daily lives. Mm-hmm. The chaos that surrounds us, we try to bind it together in some narrative that might then be somewhat linear and then therefore might have some meaning for us. Mm-hmm. This happens for this reason.
Right.
But as we know, as we're going through our day, you know, reading the newspaper or scrolling through, you know, social media, we get little snippets of information. So the narratives we try to construct, both for ourselves and for the collectivity around us, are interrupted and frustrated by external stimuli and internal stimuli. And I think when I'm writing, I like to nod to that and recognize that frustration and that interruption as part of the process. And so I like to engage narrative in my poetry, but not necessarily in a linear way. And I think perhaps that fractured nature is, this is something that goes back many, many decades at least in American poetry. But there is a feeling that really honors or at least accurately represents what it is to have a mind in our contemporary society, fractured as it is.
I think that the task of the poet to try to have the fracture, but to keep within the whole of the narrative so that it doesn't seem dispersed. It feels as if even that distraction somehow relates to the whole of the piece.
Right. Eliot says distracted by distraction from distraction, if I got those prepositions right, in his four quartets. And, of course, a great master of this was, you know, David Foster Wallace in his prose. I mean, he's interested in having those footnotes that show you what it is to have a mind that's distracted by tangential thoughts. But, of course, he also wanted to have some narrative integrity. And it's finding that balance between the two of them, creating a work of art that draws you along like a river.
Yes.
You know, you have some unified organic experience to it, but nonetheless has those little stones that you mm-hmm. bump your ankles on along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of just says something about the, you know, the hardness and the reality of the world that you're dragged along with.
There is sort of a purist view of ekphrastic writing. Maybe some of the more quote-unquote traditional styles where ekphrastic writing was line by line of observation, what you would see. You know what I'm
yes,
talking
about.
Yes, I do.
But even that is based on flawed reasoning because that implies a kind of temporality and a chronology to your perception.
And your approach is different in the way that learning to look at art in new ways can help us or make us better writers. You know, the perception is expanded so that we're interacting with the piece as we might another poem or a conversation.
Yeah, and different poets have different predispositions. I know we both love Rilke, and you know, but he was somebody who went to art more than he went to nature. I mean, if you think about it, when he comes out with that great line, "You must change your life," he's looking at a work of art when he says that, and he's not looking at a sunset.
No, he's looking at that.
So it's not quite.
Torso.
It's a different disposition than say Wordsworth or something like that. So I think all artists are helped by the conversation of art. I think that's what drives you forward, some more than others, maybe explicitly.
And the meditative process of that. I mean, in his example, he went and studied paintings of Cézanne for like 10 years.
You know,
he
and
would
wrote
go
beautifully
in, like, every
about
day
them.
And roses and, you know, all of those.
Oh, yeah. He's
a Katinga, you know, those things.
Yes. Everything he looked at very close. I mean, there's a moment just in those letters on Cézanne when he says, there's no gray in Cézanne. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that the color doesn't seem there. It's that everything that seems gray is multifaceted and has different aspects within it. And yes, that is how he got to those Dingedichte, his thing poems.
Right. So there's another piece on the acrostic table in Poets Cafe today. I wonder if we could take a look at that and if you want to introduce it or, you know, you can just read it.
Sure. I'll say a quick note, which is that the poem is called Colosseum, and it came out of a trip that I had made to the Colosseum, but it came about 10 years after I had made that trip. Colosseum. That summer, I lay in it. I was him thin. I heard the dead calling out to me across an ocean, a trial, a life. What they said was dark birds, this world, lions. Curled under the shadows of the arches, I listened for the music of surrender, the dark hymns of this one world in its singing. Wild bells in the high vaults of that city, the ancient light, the heft of it, this day. What I want still is this world only, not the pyres, not the rising light at evening, but the way down through the briar in the briar. Not fire, not the rising, but the weight. The troubled dust where the saint knelt down in lions, and his prayer was so immaculately broken that it sang to him that ruin, too, will sing you. Waste your life in singing it awake.
Gorgeous.
Thank you, Lois.
Thank you for sharing that beautiful mm-hmm. piece. And I don't know if you would consider it ekphrastic, but I do in a way. I mean, in the sense that place, you could say poetry anywhere you are is ekphrastic because you're drawing from what's around you.
Yeah, and it's coming out of another made thing.
Yeah, but in this case, there's a deep, deep history. And I've heard, you know, that going to the Colosseum, I mean, you could practically
you can't go
hear
there. Yes, you can.
The
you
roar can, of the chariots.
You can, know? And you can't go there without hearing it. And that was the experience that I had as well. And from what I can tell anybody and the people that I was there with had that feeling, I think, too. Yes, there are ghosts there. I mean, it's that kind of place.
Yeah.
You know, it's a public place where there was a lot of private suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that brings out, or at least in my case, that brought out this kind of meditation on finding a place for your own narrative. Maybe it's joy, maybe it's ecstasy, maybe it's anguish, but trying to find a place in history for it. Now, I don't say that, of course, in a narcissistic way, like anybody ought to care about what it is that I'm going through, but I think that is really the kind of pride. Well, but I think the poet has to sort of make you care. But yeah, it's finding a place, trying to do what any life does is to find a place for those massive upheavals of your heart in something like a history, and it might just be a family history. You know, it might be something not as immense as is written in the great books, but I don't know. It's a strange poem to me, and I don't quite know anything about it. It's one of those things that just sort of took about 10 years to write. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, as a reader, you don't have to know anything about it. You only have to experience it.
I think that's right.
And feel it, be there with you at that moment. Have you taught ekphrastic poetry to
I do teach it to my undergrads and my grad students, and it's a lot of fun to teach. And I think that it liberates really any writer. It certainly liberates my students because I think as much as they want to write from the eye and from the first person, it's hard to start there sometimes. And so to have that grounding of an image to jump off from, and as I said before, to try to insert a narrative, they find themselves accessing, I've seen it happen, find themselves accessing different parts of the eye, of the self, that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. And it's
Absolutely.
A really beautiful thing to watch. And some of my teachers did that with me. Eamon Grennan was a great teacher of mine when I was in grad school, and he and he did a couple of graphic exercises with us. And it was something that I had been interested in before that. But yeah, it's a wonderful exercise. And I definitely encourage anyone who's scribbling to do it. You know, go to the museum, go or just open a book of prints that you find somewhere and just start scribbling in response to it and let your mind go. You'll find that you go to places, as I say, that maybe you're blocked from.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Because there's sometimes this subliminal things that connect with an object or a person. Mm-hmm. Or a time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a one we won't get to today, but you have a poem about, is it based in like World War One or something?
I have quite a few poems based on both World Wars, but there's another one, yes, a photograph of a dead German guard in a canal outside a concentration camp, which is, of course, raises all manner of issues, moral and otherwise.
And that starting point starts with it, but then again, there's that narrative that takes off and goes in its way. And is that in some ways how you would encourage your students to just allow that?
Absolutely. Okay. I always tell my students to overwrite the piece. I compel them to do it. They say, well, no, I said there's more. We'll cut it out. Don't worry.
You know?
But I think you do need to kind of take that machete and get deep into the jungle, you know, and then you sort of figure out where you are later. You need to take that risk.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to read another? I was thinking of the Keats poem.
Sure. Okay. It's actually funny because I wrote it last time I was out here in California.
Oh, really?
And it is sort of about going west. Keats, of course, it tells us that beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. And this poem plays on that a little bit at the end. And it starts with some lines by Jack Gilbert, a great, great poet, Jack Gilbert, as an epigraph. And he says very devastatingly and simply, imagine how impossible it would be to live if some people were alone and afraid all their lives. It's called Keats. But maybe the body has no story. And if the soul is only a nostalgia for a time that was never its own, then yes, imagine the pigeon-toed boy and the girl with one arm. Imagine the waitress in the all-night diner lifting her uniform to show you the words emblazoned under her left breast's heft means it. Means beauty is truth. Because her life has had a touch too much of the latter. Because no one in this savage place will stop her, and because the trucker's hands would school you if you did. Stranger, tell me a version of your parting song, and I will tell you hers. That night, high on a sister's lifted acid, she banked a fire of her husband's cash in her own hands. And when he stumbled home to discover it in ashes, she bowed out to her lover's car in the roses and drove off from one poverty forever. And the gunshot woke the deep sleep of the neighbors. But all this is just America singing. All this is just hearsay and the summer air. And when you pay the tab and drift out through the desert heat, you have miles to go before the dark sea with its riches, the Pacific with its perfect, wordless promises, its empty voices scattering through the canyons. And when you ride out on the chattering of the interstate, you think of switchbacks, of the swinging of the winds again, of the night birds flying low across the macadam, vireo and heron scent and crow. Beauty, you are singing now in the summer air. Beauty, beauty, beauty. And why not? Why not, you are thinking? Because your fury is the alms that can't be tendered. Because these outland hands are no one's mortal blessing. Because the dead have left this drifting for the living. And because somewhere, before this maddened land is handed back to the darkness and the keening of the sea again, there is someone in the maddened dance of her vanishing, who's departing you at the wretched end of your traveling, will be all that you will ever know of lastingness, and all that you'll have needed to have known.
God, do you know this poem made me cry this morning?
Did it? I'm sorry.
No,
I hope it was a cathartic cry.
When I first read it, I read it. You know how you read a poem and then you really read a poem, and then I was like, wow, this is just so Because I think we all struggle with the light and the dark and the shadows, and how even the dark truths, as in your poem, are beautiful. And, you know, by looking into these shadows, there's like a glint on the asphalt, and there's something.
I like that image.
Yeah, and it elevates that darkness to something other.
Yeah, James Wright has a poem. He's going west in the poem, and he gets there. And at the end, he says, "America plunged into the dark furrows of the sea again." But even that, there's a sense of plunging into the dark furrows is a place in which something might be planted,
right?
And something might be born, might come up again, then harvested, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's cyclical.
Yes. Well, you can certainly say that it's true of our nation. Mm-hmm. What's happening now, and in amidst all of the darkness, many things are being born.
And Brecht has that great those great lines, "In the dark times, will there be singing?" Yes, about the dark times.
Yes. Well, you have Americana, but we won't get to that
one. Yeah, that's another long poem of mine.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful piece. But, you know, the way in which we embrace these times, and we have to embrace them, because I think it's a part of being a citizen of this planet.
Yeah, and Auden in his poem September 1st, 1939 talks about finding a way to have that affirming flame. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of the poet's task. It's not to wallow. It's as you say, one Heraclitus says, the way down and the way up are the same. That says it in a few words better than I could do in, you know, a half hour of trying to ramble into it.
Why don't we bring him
leave it at that, right? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's really great. It's a beautiful piece. And Keats, emotionally, is he one of the main people that you connect with when you're
dealing with your students? Yeah, I mean, it is.
Do the students react to him? Do they feel that?
Yeah, I think there's an immediacy to Keats. I mean, I think sometimes students might need what they perceive as immediacy in the poem. And I do tend to pick poems that I talk about with my students that have a kind of visceral bodily immediacy. This poem is called Keats because that actually grew out of a true experience as a person who had a tattoo of those words, as it says in the poem, beauty is truth. So it's encountering somebody in that circumstance with, you know, words of John Keats's on her body is quite an experience.
It got me
scribbling.
Do you know Lady Gaga has a Rilke poem on her shoulder?
Oh, really? We'll give her that, then.
We'll give her that, right? You know, she's got my vote. We're heading sort of toward the last few minutes of the show. Let's go with the guzzle poem.
Sure. So this is a poem. The guzzle form is really tweaked in what I'm doing here. And all I'm really doing is I'm writing a seven-stanza poem that every other stanza ends on a particular word. I say the first stanza ends on the word dance, the second on evening, and then it rotates from there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of form that allows for transformation, I think. And so I just wanted to close with it because I think it strikes a very different tone from some of my earlier work. It's called Guzzle. The third stanza steals a sentence. It begins with a sentence from the historian Livy. Guzzle. We are like strangers in the wild places. We watch the deer swinging the intricate velvet from its antlers, never knowing we are only as immense as what we shed in the dance. The bride and bridegroom stand at the altar. A river unfurls in their hearts. It holds the cargo of 1,000 crafts of fire that went down at evening. We can neither endure our misfortunes nor face the remedies needed to cure them. The fawns move through the forest, and we move through the ruins of the dance. Like Job, the mourner lays his head on the cold oak of the empty table. His heart is 100 calla lilies under the muck of the river, opening before evening. We think there is another shore. We stand with the new life like a mooring rope on our shoulders, never guessing that the standing still is the weight of the dance. Orpheus turned to see his Eurydice gone. The Furies tore him into pieces. The sun, he said, I will worship the sun. but something in his ruin cried out for evening, evening, evening. The wrens build at dusk. Friends, I love their moss-dressed nests twisting in the pitch of the rafters, for they have taught me that the ruins of the dance are the dance.
Thank you, Joseph, for coming back. That was a stunning, stunning poem. This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Joseph Fasano. Thanks as ever to our producer, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.